Well, I certainly enjoyed the book.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
This period in your life, of course, was the certainly the most, probably the most important in your life, because as in all childhoods, these are our formative stages.
That's right. I got most, if though not all, but most of my formative influence was early.
Yes, it was a turbulent period for you. And but also, you cashed in on a lot of interesting events that happened during that time. The thing that bothers me, though, and I'm not sure you have backed this up completely, mm-hmm. is where, on at least two occasions in Boston Boy, you describe Boston as the most anti-Semitic country in the United States. Now, obviously, there were anti-Semitic problems there, but the most anti-Semitic?
Yeah, there was a man named John Roy Carlson who's still alive. He was a reporter, researcher, and his focus then as now is on extremists of all kinds. Then the extremists who were in the news more than any other because of the German situation building over there were anti-Semites and proto-Nazis. And he traveled all over the country. And he came back and he wrote a book called, I believe, Undercover. And he said, without doubt, that Boston was the anti-Semitic capital of the country. And there were other researchers at the time who came to similar conclusions. There's something about Boston. I've been there recently and talked about this with a number of people, that leads to more intent. As you say, there is bigotry everywhere. But when you look back, for example, at the anti-Catholicism in Boston, particularly anti-Irish, during the early part of this century, it was worse in Boston than probably any other place besides Philadelphia. Then came the anti-Semitism in the 30s and early 40s. Then, as Tony Lucas points out, although he says it's a class, correctly, as a class as well as a race thing, but the racism in terms of cities up north was much more pronounced and more durable, and still is in Boston, because now, although there's a lot of anti-black feeling in places like Charleston and South Boston, Asians are getting harassed, and sometimes worse than that in certain areas. And it gets to the point, I heard a young woman told me, she's white, about 22, she moved into the North End, which is an Italian neighborhood. And the first thing her prospective landlady asked her was, do you have any black boyfriends? And she said, no. Well, that's good, she says, because you must remember this is not your home. And certain things have to be done correctly here. And about 2 days later, this young woman and a friend, also white, a woman, were walking down the street, and all of a sudden, they were surrounded by a bunch of Italian kids cursing them. And this woman said to me, do you know what they were yelling at us? Liberals. Liberals, get out of the neighborhood. I don't think there's any place in the United States in 1986 where people would... Oh, I forgot the most telling part of the story. They were being stoned at the same time. Now, that does make Boston kind of unique, and I'm not sure why this is so, except an old woman told me, you forget that the Massachusetts Bay Colony started out that way. They threw out Anne Hutchinson. The first book to be suppressed in the United States publicly was a treatise on theology, and it was in 1650. They didn't just say you can't have it in your schools or libraries. They had the public hangman burn it in the public square. I mean, what I'm saying is there's an extra intensity to the feelings there.
Well, that being aside, I have a feeling that a lot of what appears to be anti-Semitism and various acts of racism sometimes reflect childhood evil. Mm-hmm. Because if you look out on the playground, I know this when my kid was growing up, you see these kids in the playground, and while we talk about the innocence of childhood, I don't think childhood is innocent at all. I see these kids out there, they behave like animals.
Oh, children are probably more cruel, by and large, than any other age group.
They're horrible, and yeah. it takes maturation and growing up and learning to understand other people's feelings and obeying the law to straighten this thing out. So some of this anti-Semitism, I have a feeling, may be the result of just childhood evilness.
Well, the other part of the speculative theory about why Boston is so intensely bigoted might fit into that. There are no other cities, Philadelphia in part excepted, where the neighborhoods are so physically self-encapsulated. They're like fortresses. I mean, they're real turfs. So that people growing up in any of these enclaves are apt to see only people very much like themselves. And when they see other people through happenstance, through somebody coming into the neighborhood by mistake, then they react as to the enemy, because anyone who is dissimilar is the enemy. There was an evening last fall when Tony Lucas's book, Common Ground, which won the Pulitzer, I guess, about a week ago, was being discussed at Harvard. And a lot of people were discussing how valuable a book it was, and Tony was saying, again, correctly, that there's a lot of class element that goes into this beside race. Nonetheless, on the same night, in Charlestown, a Boston disc jockey took his son and a black friend of his son to dinner. He had to have, I think, at least 16 stitches before his face was familiar to him again. And he said afterwards, how stupid I was. I took a black fellow into Charlestown. Now, what you were saying is, I think, correct. Whatever that kind of animosity toward different people that would fester in almost any neighborhood somehow festers more and more harmfully in Boston.
Boston Boy deals with your childhood and young adulthood. How did what appeared to be anti-Semitism in Boston at that time affect you as an individual? How did it manifest itself?
It manifested itself in first reports. Reports of people the next block or two blocks over getting hit. This is when I was quite small, 10 or 11 years old. And then the big story that ran around the neighborhood and kept running was that a kid we knew up the block had had a pickaxe in his head and was, to say the least, never the same again. Thereafter, it hit you, if you were out at night, I was going to say if you were out alone and were Jewish in those days, it wouldn't be dangerous every night or every other night, but some night it would be. But even if you're out in a group, there would be nights when, I don't know what phases of the moon motivated the gangs to come in, but they would come into the Jewish neighborhoods, Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan at the time, looking to beat Jewish heads.
Was your head ever beaten?
Yeah, well, not my head. I lost a tooth. The most ignominious event, and I wrote about it in the book, was when I was about 14, I guess, and I was coming home from work in a candy store, and I had just bought a new recording by Muggsy Scipania's Ragtime Band. That was a series on Bluebird that was one of the notable events in jazz history. And it was an icy night, and I was clutching the record, and I fell down. The first thing I looked to see if the record was okay, miraculously it was, and I look up, and I am surrounded by six or seven rather, well, they always look taller when you're looking up at them from the ground, but let us say I was, as I say, about 14, they were 17, 18, something like that. And one of them said solicitously, are you hurt, kid? And I knew enough to know that that isn't what he was asking. He was asking, are you Jewish, kid? Which he eventually did. And I finally, after a quick debate in my mind, very quick, should I be brave and like Rambo, get up and smite them, which I didn't think I was going to be able to carry out successfully, or was I going to try to get out of this? And I said, no, I'm not Jewish, I'm Greek. Oh, come on, say something in Greek. Well, I was going to Latin school at the time, and I had my second year of Greek, and I gave them the beginning of the Odyssey. And I didn't think they'd know the difference between classic Greek and modern Greek. I hardly knew it myself. And that seemed to suffice. But I thought I had pretty much suppressed that memory until my son was bar mitzvahed years later. I had told him that story. And he, as part of his bar mitzvah speech, gave this as an example that we must be conscious of bigotry in all its phases. And look at my father. Things were so rough on Jews at that time that he had to lie and say he wasn't Jewish. This is in the middle of a synagogue. And I knew his intentions were marvelous. But it's really quite an experience to keep a straight face while you're being exposed as a coward.
Now, you did grow up Jewish in a Boston neighborhood, and yet you had difficulty in reconciling your beliefs with the Jewish faith. Tell me about that.
Well, the neighborhood was, that is, essentially Orthodox. That is, many Jews were indeed Jews who went to shul, the synagogue, every day of the week, not just on the high holidays. Even those who went only on the holidays considered themselves more or less Orthodox Jews. And there were certain tenets of the faith, rituals, that everybody or almost everybody went along with, except for the anarchists and the communists and the Trotskyites, of which we had more than a few, but the large majority of people did. And when I was pretty small, I noticed what had happened to a butcher who came into the neighborhood who was going to commit the one of the worst sins you can in terms of contempt for Jewish beliefs, he was going to have in his butcher shop both kosher and non-kosher meats. The result of that decision for him was catastrophic. They kept breaking his windows until he finally got the message and left. And I understood what they were doing, but there was something that I found very, very offensive. I thought he was offensive too, but even more offensive was this imposition of beliefs to the point where you drive somebody out of the neighborhood. I was by no means a constitutional scholar at that time, so I wasn't familiar with that ancient phrase that if you don't like certain behavior, certain actions, then you counter it with better behavior, better speech. But I found that oppressive. And I guess that started a seed that has made me rather restless with and hostile to authority, almost all authority ever since.
But not only authority, to Judaism as such, isn't it?
No. I started being an atheist when I was 13 years old, so I have a, you know, if I could believe in something, some extraterrestrial spirit, force, whatever, I would be delighted to. I'm not an atheist by disinclination to believe. It's just that I agree with Kierkegaard that the only way you can believe, at least the only way I could believe, is through a leap into faith. It's something you can't puzzle out rationally. And I've had no reason or capacity. Reason was the wrong word there. I've not been able to make that leap. But I'm, I think, for example, the Roman Catholic Church currently is doing more in terms of opposition to nuclear arms, in terms of trying to make the economy more humane, in other social issues than almost any other force in the country. And I think a good many rabbis, during the civil rights period, for example, rabbis were marching down south. No, I have no hostility to religion as such, from Judaism or any other kind.
One of the most interesting episodes in your childhood is working for an unusual man who operated a candy store, a couple of candy stores, I think. Tell me about that.
Well, there was a man named Samuel Kaplow who had gone to Harvard Business School, and through some fluke, maybe it was because of the Depression, he really was the man who should have been operating General Motors because he thought big, and he thought long before there was such a phrase as systems analysis. That's what he did. Everything was systematized. We clerks in the candy stores had a list of duties that we had to do from top to bottom of a long list every night. Everything that we said to a customer was, it wasn't computerized except that we had memorized it as if we were computers and we weren't allowed any divagations. He was a man who wanted to save time because money, of course, is time. And so he would never address us by our names. He would only address us by the first two letters of our last name. We had a manual in the store which we were required to memorize and, more to the point, to act on. And, for example, we were allowed only one, spelled out and then parenthesis Roman numeral one, piece of candy per shift. He was that kind of guy. He also employed, his clerks were all either kids going to schools like Boston Latin, which is a very prestigious school, or it still is, or to Harvard or MIT. And the neighborhood thought that was a marvelous thing he had done. He enabled us to work our way through school. There was another side to that, however. He paid us very little money for the privilege of this prestigious job. And one of the great memories of my own boyhood was organizing the clerks about 4 or 5 weeks before Christmas, when the big rush was coming in terms of private sales to corporations, and saying, either we get a raise or we shut you down. And he had so systematized the place that he couldn't have trained anybody to replace us in those 5 weeks. It took at least 4 weeks to train each clerk. So that was my first labor battle.
You had some experience on a radical newspaper along about this time, too. How did you land that job?
Well, it was a job only in the sense that lawyers do pro bono work. We didn't get paid, but for the glory of working with Francis Sweeney, it was worth much more than money at some other paper. It wasn't so much radical as it was muckraking. That is, her politics were, insofar as I can remember, she would have been called a liberal Democrat then, but she was ferociously outraged by people who abused their public trust. And in Boston at that time, that just amounted to about almost everybody. Then, she was very devout Catholic, and she became even more infuriated by the anti-Semitism in the city at the time, which was rampant, was not being criticized by most of the priests, nor by Cardinal O'Connell, who was a very Arctic patrician man, who was not himself an anti-Semite, but for some reason kept quiet about all of this. So Fran, in her paper, the Boston City Reporter, again and again would criticize the archdiocese, would criticize priests, and say this is a terrible thing for alleged Christians to be doing, to allow this anti-Semitism to go on without saying something about it. She was finally summoned to meet with the cardinal, and the only time I've seen her very scared, because the thing that she would have hated most would have been to have been excommunicated. And he was capable of it. They had a long session. We never knew what the details were, but she came back head high. She never stopped doing what she was doing, and he stopped bothering her. My guess is that he was a smart enough man to figure out that he didn't really want a martyr on his hands. And Fran would have been a very appealing martyr if she'd been thrown out of the church for preaching what after all, Christ had preached.
How did you become interested in jazz?
It started when I was very little, in the synagogue, where in the Orthodox synagogues, the primary engine of music is the cantor, the chazan, and often with a choir. But the chazan was an improviser. The basic melodies go back centuries, but a good chazan was able to improvise on those melodies with a great, great deal of passion and power and unpredictability. Within the form, you never quite knew what was going to happen, and he could really take a room and absolutely quiet it. And good chazans are very riveting. And I'd never heard anything quite like that until I was about 11 years old, walking down the main drag in Boston, and there was a record store that had a PA system. And out of the PA system, it sounded like 100 chazans, except they weren't singing. They were playing trombones and clarinets and trumpets. And it was the Artie Shaw band in Nightmare. And I just shouted, which was not the thing proper Jewish boys did in public. And I rushed into the store, and I bought the record, even though I didn't have a phonograph. And that started me. I kept looking for other kinds of emotional experiences like that in music. And I went to Duke Ellington and Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong. And I've been thoroughly hooked on jazz ever since.
You started a radio career very young.
Yeah, I was at a radio station in Boston, one of those involuntarily independent stations. That is, they couldn't get a network affiliation, so they did what they could. And we did everything from race results to whoever was cardinal or archbishop used the station, and as did James Michael Curley, the star of that late-night movie with Spencer Tracy, The Last Hurrah. And because they couldn't sell the time, they gave me a jazz series three times a week. And that was great for me because I was able then to invite people of whom I was in enormous awe, like Duke Ellington and Charlie Parker and Louis Armstrong, to come up and talk. And they would come up because they wanted to plug their local appearances, and I learned an awful lot.
You were in college during this time, weren't you?
I was at Northeastern, which then as now is essentially a working-class school. That is, most of the people who go to Northeastern come out of working-class families. Then, and I think to a somewhat lesser extent now, they were the first people of their families to go to college. There was a co-op program there long before anyone else in the country where you would work, I forget how it was, 13 weeks and then go to school 13 weeks. I didn't do that. But it was a school that was a no-nonsense school. And I much enjoyed that until I came against the administration, which was also a no-nonsense administration, run by a man named Carl S.L., whose whole life had been devoted entirely to the school. And his notion of Northeastern University, that the students were there to learn and not to say anything about things they disliked. That was not the students' function. In fact, it wasn't anybody's function. And by this time, I was on the school paper and had become editor and was doing some fairly critical stuff on the school. And we had just started planning a series on the Board of Trustees. We were going to interview each one, and we're going to ask each one, aside from having all this money that enables you to be on the Board of Trustees, is there anything you know about education? I mean, what qualifies you to set policy? That did it. And we were given an ultimatum, either cover what you're supposed to cover, like the lunchroom, or out. So we went, bravely and sadly left, and that's how I got very much interested in another of my lifetime obsessions, the First Amendment. This wasn't a First Amendment case. This was a private university, but the spirit of the First Amendment had been trampled a bit.
Some early muckraking from Nat Hentoff there in college, I guess, which laid the groundwork for later muckraking, which is in the best tradition of journalism, and don't say that critically at all. Did you at any point have a difficulty reconciling your interest in jazz and the radio with writing?
No, that actually, I'm not sure I would have been a writer had it not been for jazz. The things I most wanted to write about were the music and the players. And I started freelancing pieces, then went on to Downbeat. And then when I came to New York, it was from the music and obviously from the people who played it that I first learned a great deal more than I was able to learn from the newspapers then, and certainly not from my school books, about Jim Crow, about whole dimensions of civil rights, housing, education, etc. So I began to write about all those things, and it all came initially out of the music.
Well, Boston Boy is only the first chapter in a long career. It only takes you up to about
1953, when I came to New York from Boston.
Yeah, so I guess we'll be hearing more from you.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to do another book about, which will have sections on Malcolm X, whom I got to know pretty well, and Thelonious Monk, A.J. Musty, the radical pacifist, and a comic chapter on the Village Voice.
In addition to your current work on the Village Voice, you have turned out, an awful lot of books. You must have about 24 books to your credit, including fiction.
Yeah, I most enjoy fiction. Because it's obviously when you're doing journalism, you have to stick with the facts, otherwise you get sued. Anyway, if you don't, you don't get much respect as a journalist, but there's something about being able to create your own world that is very, very, I find very, very inviting.
Boston Boy is a good read. It reads almost like a novel, and it's a book well worth studying, and I enjoyed it a lot, and I certainly appreciate that you took half an hour off to come in and talk to me about it, and I'll certainly look forward to reading the next installment in your memoirs.
Sir.
Thank you, Ned.
All right.